Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Nigeria's political parties choose presidential candidates. Algeria kills another suspect in the kidnapping and murder of a Frenchman. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. The United Nations Ebola chief, Dr. David Nabarro, said today it will take several more months before the outbreak of the disease is under control, according to an AP report. He says greater efforts are needed to control Ebola in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan easily won primaries in his party, which has tapped him to run for another term in office. Meanwhile, the country's main opposition coalition chose Muhammadu Buhari to run against him. The 71-year-old former military ruler beat four other candidates to win the nomination of the All Progressives Congress. He won 3,430 votes out of a total of 6,000 cast. The election will take place next February. Reuters reports judges on the International Criminal Court have asked the government of Ivory Coast to turn over Simone Gbagbo. She is the wife of war crime suspect and former President Laurent Gbagbo. The AFP reports that Gbagbo ally Charles Blegoud has also been ordered to stand trial for crimes against humanity related to violence after the 2010 to 2011 election. Algeria says its soldiers have killed a second member of an Islamist group implicated in the beheading of a French mountain guide last September. The government had previously announced the death last month of another man implicated in Hervé Gurdel's kidnapping and murder. Two people are dead following a breakout of violence at the Sukoma sugar refinery in Madagascar. This is VOA News. The Associated Press reports thousands of people marched through the streets of Cotonou, Benin today, calling on the government to hold local elections that have been delayed since 2013. The march was organized by opposition parties. Reuters says the United States is warning Tanzania that corruption in its government could put some aid at risk. Tanzania has been receiving aid from a program designed to reward nations that successfully fight corruption, but recently Tanzania has seen a decline in its global corruption ranking. United Nations peacekeepers have arrested a Chadian warlord in the Central African Republic, according to Reuters. Abdel Kader Babalad was wanted by authorities for alleged abuses committed against the population in the north of the country. Lad is the leader of Chad's Popular Front for Reform. AFP reports that the European Union will not allow Libyan airlines to fly over its airspace. The EU fears that fighting between rival Libyan governments could make it impossible to ensure the safety of the nation's aircraft. Seven Libyan airlines were banned. AFP reports that state-owned South African Airways will be placed under the control of the Treasury, according to an announcement by the Cabinet. The money-losing airline will be moved from the Department of Public Enterprises to the National Treasury and will be put under the oversight of Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa. Reuters reports that the South African government is taking steps to stem the spread of power blackouts. The government will import more diesel and gas. It will also sign an agreement with a coal-fired power plant. The South Africans are experiencing their worst power shortages since 2008 due to an aging infrastructure. Hong Kong police arrested protesters who refused to leave a main pro-democracy demonstration site today. Dozens of people defied police orders to vacate the Admiralty protest camp near government headquarters. Protesters had gathered at the site for the past 75 days. Following warnings, police began hauling the protesters away one by one as fellow demonstrators cheered. Alex Chow is a student leader.
The aim is not to be arrested, but to demonstrate that the whole movement is about civil disobedience. So that means we would resist till the last moment. We will not cooperate with the government, as the government is simply violating our basic right. They are not really safeguarding our right to nominate our favorite candidates for chief executive election.
Several opposition lawmakers and student protest organizers were among those arrested. The exact number of those detained is not immediately clear. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A large-scale campaign has been launched in Sierra Leone to distribute malaria drugs to 1.5 million people. It's being done because many infected with malaria parasites have the same symptoms as those with Ebola.
That's VOA's Jody Capua reporting. Details coming up. Also in the news, President Goodluck Jonathan was declared the winner in Nigeria's ruling party primary. And Niger's prime minister says his country is facing a looming food crisis. We'll have these stories. Plus, the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour. There have been a very disturbing discovery in Sierra Leone regarding the Ebola outbreak. A World Health Organization Ebola inspection team has found 25 bodies stacked up in a closed room of the hospital in Kano this week. The discovery raises more concerns about the nation's ability to lower infection rates in a country where 7,800 people have been infected since the epidemic began in March of this year. WHO reports that two burial teams had buried 87 Ebola victims in an 11-day period. Among the dead were a nurse, an ambulance driver, and a hospital janitor recruited to remove bodies as they piled up. The 350,000 residents of the mining district are now on a 2-week quarantine. The WHO today released new figures on the Ebola outbreak. There have been more than 18,000 cases and more than 6,500 deaths. In other Ebola-related news, King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia has pledged $35 million to fight Ebola in West Africa. The gift will establish testing centers in 4 countries and provide thermal sensors and examination equipment for schools, bus stations, railroad stations, and airports. Also, the University of Geneva Hospital has temporarily stopped clinical trials of a possible Ebola vaccine when 4 of 59 volunteers complained of joint pains. Testing of the vaccine began a month ago and may be resumed on January 5th. Trials of the same drug in 4 other locations have not reported any joint problems. The vaccine was developed by New Link Genetics in Ames, Iowa, and is licensed to Merck and Company in New Jersey. In more Ebola news and a video message, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has appealed to the United States Senate Committee for more funds to fight Ebola. The committee was debating President Obama's original $6.2 billion proposal to stop the virus at home and in West Africa. The amount had just been trimmed to $5.4 billion. Mrs. Sirleaf told members of Congress that traveling the last mile to 0 new cases will be more difficult than efforts of the last few months. The World Health Organization and Ebola-affected countries in West Africa have taken the first step in what promises to be a long process in strengthening healthy systems in these poor, fragile societies. Health ministers from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, as well as representatives of major financial institutions and international and private aid agencies, are attending a high-level meeting on building resilient health systems. Lisa Schlein reports from the meeting in Geneva.
The latest WHO figures show 18,118 confirmed Ebola cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, including 6,533 deaths. During a WHO meeting in Geneva, the health ministers from the 3 Ebola-affected countries say weaknesses in their health systems led to the Ebola outbreak spiraling out of control. They also agree the laser-sharp focus on getting on top of the disease has led to the neglect of critical routine health needs. Liberia's chief medical officer, Bernice Dan, says this has created a general health crisis. She says pregnant women do not have access to health care. Children are not getting immunized against diseases. People with hypertension have to fend for themselves. She says the death of many health workers from Ebola has resulted in some health facilities closing down. Dr. Don attributes the deaths of more than 2,000 people from malaria between February and October to the lack of health services.
If you look at the general death, it's over 6,000. And that is by far higher than the number of persons who have died from Ebola in my country. We believe we could have saved some of those deaths if our hospitals are open and functioning whilst we focus on getting rid of Ebola. And so for my country, we decided to take a two-pronged approach, continue to fight Ebola to get it to zero, and revive routine healthcare services.
Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are among the poorest countries in the world. All three have recently emerged from years of conflict with shattered healthcare systems. Even before Ebola struck, these countries were unprepared to deal with the normal demands of their populations. WHO reports these countries only had one or two doctors for 100,000 people. Since Ebola, the situation has worsened as more than 600 healthcare workers have been infected with the virus. Sierra Leone's Minister of Health and Sanitation, Aboubakar Fofana, says in the absence of a functioning health system, a small, localized problem can rapidly become an epidemic or even a pandemic. He says it is crucial to strengthen these failing systems. He says he welcomes discussion during the meeting, but voices reservations about the framework proposed by WHO for building a strong health facility.
If you look at it keenly, it is a wonderful model, but it works best under normal circumstances. But these are abnormal circumstances, so now it's a we need to think outside the box and come up with those low-hanging fruits that we can quickly put in place, get rid of this epidemic, and then we regroup and then match the health systems properly.
The World Health Organization suggests following a primary health care approach that brings services close to home with community involvement. It says the systems and resources currently being mobilized in the fight against Ebola should eventually be integrated into post-Ebola health infrastructure and services. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A large-scale campaign has been launched in Sierra Leone to distribute malaria drugs to 1.5 million people. It is being done because many infected with malaria parasites have the same symptoms as those with Ebola. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Doctors Without Borders and the Ministry of Health are distributing the drugs in the capital Freetown and five nearby districts. Teresa San Cristobal is emergency desk manager for the medical aid group, also known as MSF. She's in Freetown and coordinating the distribution of the anti-malarials.
Malaria is one of the main burdens for the population. Sierra Leone is the fifth country with the highest prevalence of malaria. Many, many people die of malaria or have complications with malaria.
Malaria is the biggest killer of children under age 5 in Sierra Leone. The door-to-door distribution of the malaria drugs is expected to ease the burden at Ebola treatment centers and also help prevent malaria patients from also becoming infected with the Ebola virus. About 6,000 Ministry of Health volunteers are distributing the medication that is used to both treat and prevent malaria. San Cristobal says it's difficult to tell the difference between those with symptoms of malaria and those with Ebola.
You have fever, you have vomit, diarrhea. You have a lot of common symptoms between both of the disease. Normally, you cannot presume that something is malaria. You have to be sure if it is malaria or if it is Ebola.
She says those suspected of having Ebola must be isolated and tested. It's unclear whether there's actually an increase in malaria cases this year. That's because fewer people are going to health centers out of fear of catching Ebola. The MSF emergency desk manager says a second mass distribution of anti-malaria drugs is scheduled for early January in Freetown and the Western area. As the Ebola crisis continues, San Cristobal describes the situation as alarming. Sierra Leone has more new cases being reported than Liberia and Guinea. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has appealed to the United States Senate Committee for more funds to fight Ebola. And President Goodluck Jonathan was declared the winner in Nigeria's ruling party primary. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Kenyan lawmakers are debating a security bill aimed at combating increased terror threats and attacks in the country. The proposed security law would give more power to the security. However, the bill faces criticism because opposition politicians, legal experts, and activists fear the proposed security laws may infringe people's rights and threaten democratic gain made in the country. Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Kenya is facing a security challenge from a rise in terrorism and criminal activities. In less than 10 days recently, Al-Shabaab fighters crossed from Somalia, attacked a bus and quarry, killing more than 60 people. The Kenyan public has been angry at the government for failing to protect them from terror groups and criminals. Responding to public pressure, the government proposed laws that will change how the country's security agencies handle and provide security. The legislation gives the National Intelligence Service spy agency powers to arrest and detain terror suspects for 1 year and the power to intercept communications without a court order. Journalists and social media users could face a jail term of up to 3 years and a stiff fine for publishing or broadcasting photographs of terror victims without the authorization of the police and the victim. Parliamentary Majority Leader Aden Duale says the bill needs some changes, but he's confident lawmakers will iron out their differences.
We must rise to the occasion. We must look at this bill with soberness and look at the bill and say, the following areas are okay. The following areas, we need to relook at it. And as a house, with the interests of the country, with the interests of the security challenges we have, I have no doubt in my mind, Honorable Speaker, that we will come together to a table. We will protect the Constitution.
Opposition lawmaker Ababu Namwamba told colleagues the proposed law will catch up with them and it will be a return to a one-party state.
This bill is an epitome, the manifestation, the face of impunity, this bill. This bill will lead to securitization of our state to a level that even yourselves, as the representatives of the people, cannot bear. This bill, Honorable Speaker, is an express visa to a return to the autocratic Jomo and Moi states that we thought we had buried in the dustbins of history. It is a bad law.
Kenyan lawmakers supporting the law say the country needs a tougher way to fight increased terror threats. Security agencies have complained against the judiciary for giving bail to terror suspects they have presented to the courts. Advocates have accused the police of doing shoddy work that has made it hard to prosecute terror suspects. Kenya has made some changes. Police Chief David Kimayo resigned and Joseph Olelenku was dismissed as Cabinet Secretary for the Interior after the quarry attack. If the new security law is passed, it will give the President the power to pick the police chief. With the approval of Parliament, meaning the current National Police Service Commission and other voting bodies won't have a say on the appointment. Critics say the proposed security bill could curtail democratic gains by giving the president sweeping powers to clamp down on press freedom and freedom of expression. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Niger's prime minister says his country is facing a looming food crisis that could be made worse by an influx of refugees from neighboring Nigeria. That region borders Nigeria's Borno state, the scene of many attacks by the Boko Haram militant group. Nearly 90,000 refugees have arrived in Difa since last May. The prime minister says the Difa region has had many poor harvests. About 500,000 people there are reported to be facing food shortages, with many children suffering acute malnutrition. And President Goodluck Jonathan was declared the winner in Nigeria's ruling party primary. Mr. Jonathan was the only candidate of the People's Democratic Party. Nigerians cast votes for president on February 14th. Leading candidates of the opposition party are Muslims from the north, including former Vice President Atiku Abubakar and wealthy businessman and former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari. Mr. Jonathan's opponents criticize him for not suppressing a four-year insurrection in the north by Boko Haram. The United Nations Special Representative and head of the mission in South Sudan, Ellen Margaret Loy, urged warring parties to speed up their commitment to the peace process. Loy also cautioned that UN bases hosting tens of thousands of internally displaced persons, or IDPs, must not be considered permanent homes. Philip Tone Aliyu has more from Juba on the one-year anniversary of the conflict.
Loy says that when she agreed to lead the UN peacekeeping mission amid the enormous suffering endured by the people of South Sudan, she knew the challenges awaiting her. She says the decision to provide shelter for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese fleeing violence will go down in the history of UN peacekeeping missions as a huge success. But
it's also important to remember that these so-called protection of civilian sites on unmanned bases were always envisioned as temporary solutions to protect civilians in imminent danger of physical violence. It was not and is not supposed to become permanent settlement. Therefore, we need to focus more on fostering a safe and secure environment outside the UN camps.
That means enabling IDPs to leave the camps and start new lives without fear of being attacked. Loy says the UNMISS protection of civilian side in the Lagos state's capital Rumbek closed this month after the displaced people living there found a separate area to settle. Loy says similar arrangements are being made in Juba. She says the UN will help ensure that civilians are protected even after they leave UNMISS bases, but that responsibility lies with others.
We should never forget that the ultimate responsibility for protection of civilians remains with the government, including its national security forces, the SPLA, and the South Sudan National Police Service. It is first and foremost their responsibility to provide security to the citizens of their country.
As of this week, nearly 100,000 civilians remain at UNMISS POC sites around South Sudan. Another 1.5 million people are displaced inside South Sudan, and 750 others have fled across the borders to neighboring countries. The one-year-old conflict has led to the deaths of at least 10,000 people, according to the UN. Efforts by mediators from the regional bloc, IGAD, to end the conflict between the two warring parties are due to resume next week. Last month, the peace talks were postponed to allow for consultative meetings. Also, in November, the UN Security Council renewed the UNMISS mandate with a particular focus on the protection of civilians. Loy says UN member states were sending the leaders of the government and rebels a clear message.
The patience of the international community with both parties is wearing thin, and their leaders must inject a new sense of urgency into the peace process in order to reach a comprehensive peace agreement as soon as possible. We sincerely hope that representatives of both parties at the IGAD-sponsored peace talks will return to the negotiation table with a heightened sense of responsibility and openness to compromise, and hopefully that can bring the talks to a swift and successful conclusion.
Loi says UNMISS officials will continue to monitor and report on human rights violations.
A legacy of impunity for serious human rights violations in the past has contributed to the current crisis. This legacy must stop, and stop now.
Experts say South Sudan faces crippling institutional weaknesses that impede progress. Human rights advocacy groups have documented numerous abuses, including targeted killings, detention, and forced disappearance seen last December, and they continue their calls for justice and accountability. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees is appealing to nations to protect and come to the rescue of thousands of people embarking on dangerous sea journeys in search of asylum. High Commissioner Antonio Guterres is hosting a special two-day meeting to try to persuade nations that concerted action is needed to save the lives of these desperate people. Lisa Schlein reports from the meeting in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency estimates nearly 350,000 people have made the dangerous sea crossings in search of asylum and migration this year. This has resulted in 4,272 reported deaths. The majority of those crossing are Africans and Middle Easterners trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. But UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards notes war and poverty in the Horn of Africa are pushing people across the Gulf of Aden. He says people from Western Burma are taking deadly routes in Southeast Asia. Edwards says the focus of the High Commissioner's meeting is on saving lives. He tells VOA it is difficult to do this without looking at the root causes that prompt people to take these dangerous journeys.
Wherever we look, we're seeing people fleeing real difficulty. And there comes the problem. If someone is fleeing a war, fleeing a conflict, and trying to have a case for asylum made or trying to seek safe haven, if you turn them back, then all that happens is you simply increase the risks for those people. So the bottom line here is deterrence alone doesn't work to solve this problem. Dealing with criminal networks alone doesn't solve this problem. You have to look at it in its entirety and deal with it. It's a transnational problem. It needs transnational thinking and solutions.
Edwards says it is easier to see the problems than the solutions. He says problems that create asylum seekers have to be addressed at the source. He says people have to consider what can be done along the routes to provide safe and legal means for people to apply for asylum or for travel visas. The UNHCR spokesman says, unfortunately, some governments are giving higher priority to keeping foreigners out than granting asylum to those in genuine need.
Politically, in many countries, we are seeing a shift in favour of border protection rather than protection of lives of people arriving in countries. That is a problem and has to be looked at. We understand the moods in many countries in these difficult times, with record levels of displacement. But the basics have to remain in place. We have to uphold the human rights and the right to asylum, which have been so much a part of our humanity in the entire Second World War, post-Second World War era. It's important that those are maintained.
Participants at the High Commissioner's meeting agree that much of the international focus on sea migration is on the irregular or criminal nature of this activity. They stress that the people undertaking these journeys are not the criminals, but are the victims of criminal gangs that traffic in the desperation of others for profit. They say it is the right thing for nations to prevent this exploitation and to provide protection and hope to asylum seekers and migrants seeking a better future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news? interviews, analysis. We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. There has been a very disturbing discovery in Sierra Leone regarding the Ebola outbreak. And Niger's prime minister says his country is facing a looming food crisis that could be made worse by an influx of refugees from neighboring Nigeria. Coming up, music from Ghana in our feature segment, South Sudan critical of Transparency International for ranking it as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. I'm Yehiz Wuhib and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with African football.
Yehias, the 30th Africa Cup of Nations football tournament kicks off January 17th in Equatorial Guinea. The host country will play Congo Brazzaville in the opening match in the port city of Bata. In the day's second match, also in Bata, Gabon will go against Burkina Faso. Our VOA football fans will remember Gabon co-hosted the 2012 Nations Cup tournament with Equatorial Guinea, while Burkina Faso lost to Nigeria 1-0 in the 2013 Nations Cup final in Johannesburg. Our African football guru in Johannesburg, David Legg, has been analyzing the previous head-to-head matchups for the various teams in next month's tournament. And David joins us again this evening for a look at Group A.
Yes, Sammy, what's interesting, first of all, is that Group A, which consists of Congo, Brazzaville, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, and Burkina Faso, they have never played each other. So, in other words, all six fixtures in that group will be first fixtures between the respective countries. And the other interesting thing about Group A is that essentially it is a Central African Championship because you've got Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, and Congo Brazzaville all from that region. And the only outsiders, so to speak, are Burkina Faso. And that's unusual, Sonny, that you have that many Central African teams in the Africa Cup of Nations and also that they're all in the same group. In Group B, three of the six fixtures have got some history to them. First of all, let's look at Zambia against Democratic Republic of Congo. They met twice way back in 1974. It was the final of that competition. It ended in a 2-2 draw. And in the only final that's been replayed in the history of the African Cup of Nations, the Democratic Republic of Congo, who were then known as Zaire, won by 2-0. And that tournament incidentally was played in Egypt. There's quite a history between Zambia and Tunisia. They've met four times, and I'm afraid not good news for all our Zambian listeners. Tunisia have won two of the matches, and the other two have been drawn. Another little worry is that when Tunisia won their two matches, they scored four goals on each occasion. So Zambia, you could say, will be very much out for revenge when they play the Tunisians in a match that could well decide who wins Group B. Tunisia and the DR Congo, they've also met before, three times. And here again, the advantage very much historically with the Tunisians. They've won two of those games and the other is drawn. So if anybody thinks that the Tunisians are favourites for Group B, those thoughts are certainly backed up by statistics. On, Sunny, to Group C, this is the group of death, or in my humble opinion, one of the two groups of death. It features Ghana, Senegal, Algeria and South Africa. Many people will probably think South Africa are the outsiders in this group, despite their good form in the qualifiers. But the interesting thing is that South Africa have never lost to any of their three rivals in previous Cup of Nations. They've beaten and drawn with Algeria. They've beaten Ghana twice and drawn once. And they've drawn once with Senegal. So cause, I suppose, therefore, some optimism for Bafana Bafana ahead of this really tremendous group. One in which I still feel Sunny's going to have a lot of drawn games. I wouldn't be surprised if a team getting even 4 points could well qualify from this group. And then we go on to Group D, and the statistic here that really stood out for me was Cameroon against Ivory Coast. They have met seven occasions before in the competition, going right back to 1970 when Cameroon won 3-2. Now, given the rivalry between these two countries and the strength of them, I would have expected it to be a very close head-to-head situation. But it's not, Sunny. In fact, Cameroon have won five of the previous seven meetings, and the other two ended in draws. So a distinct advantage there for Cameroon. And, of course, also a reminder to our listeners that in the qualifiers for 2015, the countries also met. Cameroon had a decisive 4-1 victory in Yaoundé, and then held on pretty impressively for a goalless draw with 10 men in Abidjan. So I think you could say advantage Cameroon as far as that pairing. Other interesting things, Sonny, normally in the 16-nation Africa Cup of Nations finals, you find that there's a reasonably even number of French and English-speaking countries, but not on this occasion. 11 of the 16 finalists are French-speaking countries. Only three are English-speaking. They're Ghana, South Africa, and Zambia. There is one Portuguese-speaking country, that's Cape Verde, and one Spanish, in fact, the only Spanish-speaking country in Africa, and that's the host nation, Equatorial Guinea. And also, what's a little unusual is the regional breakdown of the 16 finalists. You've got seven from West Africa, no real surprise there, but you've got an unusually large number from Central Africa, that's five. North Africa's got only two. They would, of course, have had three if Morocco had not been disqualified as hosts. And Southern Africa, that's Zambia and South Africa, they've got two each. So the surprise there really that North Africa have only got two and Central Africa have got five. Also, if you look at the qualifying rounds compared to the finals, we've got three repeats. We're going to have Cape Verde against Zambia, and they beat each other in the qualifiers. We've got, as I previously mentioned, Cameroon and Cote d'Ivoire resuming hostilities. And we also got Gabon against Burkina Faso. They'll be in Group A, and Gabon won at home and drew away in the qualifying phase.
Thanks for that in-depth Nations Cup analysis, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Vodavirus, named after a river in Congo, where the disease was first discovered in 1977. It spread through direct contact with the blood of an infected person, through contact with needles and other infected objects of persons, and also contact with infected animals, possibly by eating infected meat. Symptoms of Ebola include fever, headache, joints and muscle pain, followed by vomiting and severe diarrhea, rashes, internal and external bleeding. Ebola has no cure. Infected person must be isolated, or infection may spread to others. If you know anyone exhibiting the Ebola symptoms, do not wait. Ensure that person is taken to the nearest hospital for tests to be done. So let us all take action now. Africa.
From Liberia to Nigeria.
From Guinea to Sierra Leone. Take precaution. Be safe. It could be your mama, papa, brother or sister. Take precaution. Be safe. God bless Africa. Africa. We are project.
Thank you, George Weah. Just ahead on the Sunny Side of Sports, Marco Uma will tell us about how Olympic athletes from Egypt and Tunisia have received awards.
In Olympic news, Tunisian Meriem Cherni Mizouni received the International Olympic Committee's Women and Sports World Trophy in Monaco. She was the first Tunisian female Olympian in 1976. The accolade is in recognition of her contribution to the promotion of women in sports in Tunisia. Staying in Monaco, Egypt's Aya Mahmoud Medani received the International Olympic Committee's Trophy for Africa. She is a three-time Olympian in modern pentathlon, having first competed at the Olympics at the tender age of 15. Upon retiring, she has made a significant contribution towards the introduction of biathlon in Egyptian schools and worked to raise funds for equipment to enable women and girls participate in sports while also pursuing their formal education.
I'm Shegun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on!
In pro basketball news, the Golden State Warriors are off to a golden start this NBA season. The Warriors beat the visiting Houston Rockets Wednesday night 105-93 for their 14th straight victory. Golden State also improved its league-best record to 19 wins and 2 losses and helped new head coach Steve Kerr carve out a slice of NBA history. Kerr became the first rookie coach to win 19 of his first 21 games. Some of our VOA basketball fans might remember when Steve Kerr was a sharp-shooting guard in the NBA, and he also experienced success as a player. The 49-year-old Kerr won 3 NBA championships with the Chicago Bulls and 2 more titles with the San Antonio Spurs. The Los Angeles Clippers have also been playing some very good basketball lately. The Clippers beat the host Indiana Pacers Wednesday night 103-96 for their 9th consecutive victory. The Clippers will try to make it 10 in a row here in Washington Friday night when they take on my beloved Washington Wizards. The Wizards, waving their wands Wednesday night, beat the Orlando Magic 91-89 on a buzzer-beating shot by Bradley Beal. Go Wizards! I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudan critical of Transparency International for ranking it as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And next, we focus on Zambia's copper and cobalt mines. But first, some music. Here is Daddy Lumba of Ghana with Tini.
Jimmy, Tubal Jimmy, Tubal Jimmy.
Daddy Lumba of Ghana, Wetini. The government of South Sudan is critical of Transparency International for ranking the young nation as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. Information Minister Michael Mukui says bringing peace to South Sudan is the top priority of his government and should be the priority of the international community as well, not measuring corruption. He tells VOA fellow Nabil Biagio that the report reflects the opinion of a few individuals in South Sudan and not the entire nation.
The report of the Transparent International is their report. That is a report which is prepared by individuals. It's not substantiated. It is individual opinions which are just compiled, and they are said to be a report of an organization. They come and conduct researches without even the involvement of the person concerned, or they don't even submit a report to that person so that he can respond to it. I really doubt the credibility of the report.
It's usually based on the perceptions of the public about how corrupt the public sector is in a particular country. They speak to certain individuals, and based on the public trust in government and leaders in the country, they submit this report.
Well, yes, they talk to individuals in those countries. Those individuals, what is the criteria for their selection? Out of, say, 100, if you can interview 10, These 10 may be people who have their own intentions, their own opinion, and as such, they are ready to say whatever. The other 90 which you left out may be the people who, if you were to talk to them, they would have reversed the whole thing. So this issue of random selection does not at times send a clear message about whatever is written there.
So if we put this report aside for a bit, observers say signs of corruption in South Sudan are all around, like poor schools, inhibited economic growth, poor service delivery and all of that.
But they may not necessarily be because of corruption. It could be because of inexperience. It could be for any other reason. It may be because of misplacement of funds and spending the funds on other issues other than concentrating on other issues and so forth. That is one. Number two, the question of priorities is not the decision of everybody. It is not anybody in the international community that must come and determine the priorities of X or Y. It is X or Y who determines what are his or her priorities. So the fact that there is a poor educational system, there are no proper health services, does not necessarily mean corruption.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwi speaking to VOA fellow Nabil Biagio from Juba. Zambia is internally recognized as a producer of copper and cobalt. It's the world's seventh largest producer of copper, generating more than 3% of the world's production. VOA's Paul Indiho recently visited the country's largest slug dump, located in Wiskele Township, Kitwe, where illegal miners are urging the government to open up the mines.
Copper mining is Zambia's main economic lifeblood, and the mineral accounts for close to two-thirds of the country's earnings. And copper mines are a major employer in the country of more than 14.5 million people. Privatization of the mines in the early 90s relieved the government from covering losses generated by the industry and greatly increased copper mining output. However, with privatization comes layoffs. It meant that some people had to be laid off, which resulted in high unemployment for people who depended on the mines for their livelihood. The youth here call this the Black Mountain. They argue that there are a lot of minerals. So they want the government actually to give them rights to legally mine this Black Mountain. There is an ownership controversy surrounding Black Mountain. A group of Chinese investors are claiming ownership and are using the police to chase away thousands of young people who depend on this mountain. A driver through Wasikili Township confirms the controversy. I met up with a group of young people commonly known as jail boys or illegal miners who express their concern.
Once they give us another opportunity to start working from here, they should also help us to look for people who are capable, who have machinery to help us.
Davaisa Simiola is the area councillor of Wasikili Ward, Kitwe City Council. He says that the mining companies are not doing enough to employ the youth, and he wants the mines to be controlled by the locals.
Not going to allow any Chinese to come and operate from this, because this thing belongs to the youth of this area. Okay. They were given by the Honorable Minister. Mm-hmm. So we are not going to allow any Chinese.
Councillor Christopher Kangombe represents a Riverside Ward and says that the mining companies need to do more to improve the living standards of the people in Kitwe.
We would want to appeal to the mines that even as they run the mining business itself, which is their core business, they should remember that Zambia, culturally, we've relied on the mining industry to raise other social amenities.
Speaking exclusively to Voice of America, the Zambian Minister of Mines revealed that the government is in the process of issuing mining licenses to the youth.
Black Mountain, it must be mined properly, otherwise it can be catastrophic in the sense that that thing can collapse. Looking at the methodology, mining methodology the people are applying, they are digging in. That can be disaster. But we want you to get organized, and we shall formulate and give you licenses and have you trained and get some people can guide so that you can exploit this Black Mountain.
Jackson Askamo is the president of Zambia Chamber of Mines, the body responsible for promoting the interests of the mine owners. He says the mining companies are doing enough to employ Zambians.
At the time the mines were being privatized in 2000, there was no single job on the mines which had not been done successfully by a Zambian. So we have Zambians working on these mines at all levels.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has surpassed a Zambian copper output production for the first time since 1998, making it Africa's biggest copper producer. Reporting for VOA News, Paul Ndiho in Copper Belt, Kitwe, Zambia.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehisu Hib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In today's world, regional threats like the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, if left unaddressed, will become global threats, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. That's why the United States and its allies are ramping up the fight against ISIL, an organization that rapes and brutalizes women and sells them as child brides. It viciously and indiscriminately attacks groups of all ethnicities, sects, and religions, including Jews, Christians, and Muslims. ISIL's goal is to impose their reign of terror over as many people and as much territory as it can by any means necessary. They call it a caliphate, said Secretary Kerry, but in reality, it's a zone of chaos and destruction. Since September, President Barack Obama has outlined America's plan to mobilize a broad coalition to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL. And progress has been achieved. Already, ISIL's hold on territory has been reversed from the Mosul Dam to territory north of Tikrit and to the Baiji oil refinery where ISIL has been driven out. The people of Amirli were liberated, and in Kobani, Kurds were putting up a fierce and brave fight in order to rout ISIL forces. ISIL's finances have been severely restricted thanks to efforts by the U.S., Gulf states, and others. Moreover, the message of ISIL is being challenged by Islam's highest authorities. The Grand Mufti of Egypt declared that ISIL is the organization of Satan. Major mullahs, imams, and clerics are all speaking out in Friday prayer against the notion that ISIL has any legitimacy. Ultimately, said Secretary Kerry, ISIL is no match for the United States and its allies. We will gain the inevitable triumph, he said, and build a peaceful and secure future for the Middle East and, by extension, for the entire world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.